My name is Bob Whitaker, and this is Porch Talk. I'm retired from editing and worrying about whether I say or whether I breathe deeply or whatever. And what I'm going to do is just talk to you as an old fella who might have something to say, like on a porch in South Carolina. There was a guy in a Washington restaurant who was choking on a piece of steak. Nobody in the restaurant seemed to know nobody in the restaurant seemed to know the Heimlich maneuver, or at least they were too afraid of lawsuits to try it. But one guy walked up and said, "Listen, don't worry about it. I do this all the time." So he grabbed the guy by the testicles and squeezed hard, and the guy went, "Ugh!" And the piece of meat came out. The waiter there was very impressed, and he said, "I've never seen that procedure before. Are you a doctor?" And the fellow replied, "No, I work for the IRS. The IRS guy knew how to get things out of people. And while none of us would particularly admire his methods, one thing the joke talks about is the fact that this guy from the IRS knew something. He knew how to do things. What really amazes me about experts today is they can't do anything. And of course, the best example is that we read regularly in the Wall Street Journal about scientific tests that compare highly paid market analysts and the results of their recommendations with chimpanzees or monkeys throwing darts at the Fortune 500 or some other stock list. It sounds like a joke, and of course it is a joke, but the fact is that the chimpanzees tossing those darts and the market analysts that we pay a fortune to come out dead even. Anybody who has bought mutual funds knows that how the mutual fund performs will be more or less how the market performs. In the meantime, directly or indirectly, you're paying a fortune for these people who have corner offices and high pay, and who scientifically, I'm talking about scientific tests, have no results at all to show. Yet, in the what should be the most practical place in the world, Wall Street, these people continue to get paid. Nobody questions it. If you lose money and you say, "Well, I had a highly paid economic consultant doing the analysis on this," people will say, "Well, that's a shame." If you say, "Well, actually, I was following a bunch of chimpanzees throwing darts," people would say, "Well, you deserve to get screwed. You know that those were not experts." But scientifically, the results are exactly the same, which leaves me in a position of feeling maybe I've taken some LSD by mistake. This actually happens. It doesn't just actually happen. It's actually happened for a whole generation now. The people who get paid by the capitalist system are people who do nothing except come out with highly complicated formulae with big words and get paid for it. And you and I are doing the paying. They have no results. They claim no results. But nobody seems to feel a little bit cold at this idea. The old guy here on the porch says, "That's weird. here are people putting out good money for nothing. Now, back when I was raised, oh Lord, here he comes again, back when I was raised, I had a certain naive respect for experts. My father was an expert. In fact, no one questioned it. He was the world's leading consultant on brickmaking. He was able to find the right clay, dry it, fire it at exactly the right temperature, and turn it into exactly the color, exactly the strength of brick that his customers needed. His book was called Drying and Firing. Very sophisticated title. It went into detail about how you take clay, what clay you take exactly, how you cook it, how you first dry it, then how you fire it, in order to produce the exact type of brick that people want. One of the biggest things about brick is, of course, the color. It happens that my father was totally colorblind, but he still managed to produce the best brick there were. I remember once he brought back a flyer from a ceramic convention. It's been at that time a brick plant convention. We're talking about the 50s. Modern ceramics weren't in vogue yet. And the flyer said, referred to Carolina Ceramics quality brick. Carolina Ceramics was our tiny little brick plant that my father had built in South Carolina. It happened that since he was a genius in the business of making brick, Carolina Ceramics had a terrific name among brick-making people, although it had never been heard of outside of the brick-making community, I guess you'd call it. There was a journal called the Brick and Clay Record, which was produced in Ohio, and the American Ceramic Society, which was mostly brick at, we're talking about the 50s, the American Ceramic Society produced this Brick and Clay Record. My father had an article in just about every copy of it. My father was sent over to Russia to give them advice about the brick industry. And at that time, brick making was what we would call today a relatively small business. I guess relative to Xerox or some of these giant corporations. The point being that if somebody paid my father's rather exorbitant fees and his flight to wherever they were, Europe or the United States or wherever they were, they had to make that advice count. They had a problem. They asked my father about it, and the question was, what did he do about it? And I can guarantee you that if my father had not solved their problem, he would not have been called back. They really couldn't afford that. Even the great big brick plants could not afford to throw away money on somebody who showed up there, spent a couple of days around, told them what to do, left, and nothing happened. Of course, today we have consultants coming into big business and they have long, complicated reports, and they're not supposed to actually do anything, but in the annual report, the manager can say, well, we called in these consultants, so-and-so, a long name, and all that stuff. It is used as a report. It's used as a cover. But back then, my father always had to come through with results. Now, my father and I cordially disliked each other, but there was never any question that he knew everything there was to know about brick. He knew where to find the clay. He would taste the clay to find out exactly what kind of brick it would make. He knew exactly, in every case, how to dry that clay, then how to take the clay that had been dried, formed and dried, and to burn it exactly, so that it would come out exactly the way that it was supposed to come out. He used to have a certain amount of trouble with the police, in fact, in small towns, because he would wander around and he would look at brick walls. Now, the police get a little nervous when some nut is wandering around looking at brick walls. He actually would walk up and taste the brick wall so that he would know what kind of clay it was, how it was burned. He'd be able to tell you all those things. Today it'd be considered almost miraculous. He could tell you all about that brick just by looking at it, colorblind and all, and by tasting the brick. Very few people taste brick these days. I guess it's sort of out of date. They taste champagne, but not brick. I ran into exactly the same problem my father had run into when I was in Pulaski, Tennessee. Pulaski, Tennessee was the birthplace of the Ku Klux Klan, and they were holding a march for white pride and white survival. Since I have retired, I no longer have to satisfy any respectable people, and I divide the world into two types of people. Those who want the white race to survive, and those who want to destroy the white race. Let me repeat my mantra. Anti-racism today, as used by respectable conservatives and liberals, means that every white country on earth, and only white countries, have to bring in large numbers of non-whites from the third world and integrate with them. The universal statement of both respectable conservatives and liberals is that this will solve, quote, the race, unquote, problem. This race problem does not exist in Asia, does not exist in Japan, does not exist in Taiwan, does not exist in Africa. Nobody expects black countries to bring in huge numbers of non-blacks and integrate with them in order to solve some race problem. So it doesn't really take a nuclear scientist to figure out that solving the race problem means solving the white problem. To repeat, if a group of countries were randomly selected as the ones on Earth which had to bring in people of another race, and those countries were Jamaica, all of Africa, in fact, every black country on the face of the earth, and everybody were to say, we're not going to bother anybody else, but you have to solve the race problem by bringing in lots and lots of non-blacks, integrating with them. I don't think it would take very long for people to figure that whoever was doing this really hated blacks. So today, when a respectable conservative, a Bill O'Reilly or Sean Hannity or whoever else, is allowed to talk on national television, he always agrees with the liberals that the race problem must be solved, and that these countries with a race problem must bring in lots and lots of third worlders and integrate with them. And once again, these countries with this race problem are always white. Every white country and only white countries. It doesn't take a nuclear scientist or brain surgeon to figure out what the underlying theme here is. It is called genocide. Whites must go. So I was in Pulaski, Tennessee, the birthplace of the Ku Klux Klan, to march with other whites who were marching for the survival of the white race. Unapologetically, I didn't give a damn whether they were Ku Klux Klan or any other group. The world is divided now for me into those who want to destroy us and those who want to save us. And of course, the sort of washout neutrals. So I was in Pulaski, and there was a certain amount of tension in Pulaski because of this Klan march. And here was some nutcase who had learned a lot from his father, wandering around looking at brick walls. Pulaski, actually, I don't know why, but the place has the most amazing brick walls. They use brick that are fired entirely differently from entirely different places, different colors. For somebody like me, it's a tour. So there I was, with the Klan march just about to occur. I was back there, staring at a brick wall. I didn't actually taste it. I didn't have that ability that my father had. But it was a history. It was an amazing history to me, and I was looking at it and thinking about it. And, as so often happens in my life, a police car pulled up. And they were slightly curious as to what this elderly gentleman was doing, standing there, staring at a brick wall. So I told them. They believed me, just as they always believed my father. Because really, there isn't much criminal activity. Odd as it may seem for a man to be staring at a brick wall, it certainly doesn't involve any violence to persons or property. And they thought it was amusing. So, that was my little brush with the police again. Usually my brushes with police have to do with something else, but in this case it was exactly the same as my father's. I was standing there staring at a brick wall. I didn't actually taste it, but that was only because I didn't know how to. I wish I did. To me, the whole thing about brick, it's fascinating. You can tell where brick came from. My father used to say, all these people talk about their brick came from Europe. He said, you just give me a shovel in an hour and I'll tell you exactly where this brick came from. There's the story about the ballast where they needed heavy stuff coming from England, and therefore they took brick over and houses were built from this very sophisticated British brick. The story said that when we sent things to Europe, it was in the form of raw materials, which were very heavy, and the same boat would come back with finished materials, which were relatively light, and so they needed ballast, and so they would put lots and lots of brick into the boats. So people would say that their old house was built out of European brick, not American brick. But he thought that was nonsense, and he could prove it with a shovel. And that's kind of expert I was raised around. Back in the 50s, Americans were kind of famous for being experts at knowing things. I went to high school with a bunch of teenagers that worshiped their cars. Of course, they couldn't afford anything but their cars. They had to fix them themselves. And one guy telling me, I don't know He said, my car wouldn't know how to act if it had more than 50 cents worth of gas in it. Well, back then that was a gallon and a half. And the young people then, young guys, could literally take their car apart and put them back together. They were just teenagers. They weren't experts. Experts were people who really knew how to do stuff, knew how to do real things. So I was pretty naive about the whole business of experts. So when I got into the university when I was 16 and I started hearing about experts in political science, experts in history, it took me years to realize these people truly, honestly, sincerely, didn't know anything. That is to say, they couldn't do anything. They couldn't analyze anything. They just pleased other experts and therefore got ordained as experts themselves. So what other people, more or less, I suppose, take for granted is something somebody, an overeducated redneck from Pontiac, South Carolina, which sounds like a joke, but again, it isn't. I had to learn that from scratch. I couldn't believe it. Back in the 50s, a book came out. It was a wild runaway bestseller by Dale Carnegie called How to Win Friends and Influence People. And nothing that he wrote there had to do with knowing things. One thing that stands out in my mind is that he said, it is critical, if you're going to be a success, to remember people's names. The message here was that in politics, for example, it doesn't really matter what you do about the future of your country or busing your children across town, busing the constituents' children across town. It doesn't matter what you do in the committee room that impacts everybody's lives. The one thing that a constituent will not forgive is that you don't remember his name. Well, I was so naive, I had a little trouble with this idea that constituents would sell their country out because somebody remembered their names. It is, however, absolutely true. If you can remember names, it is a huge balance against any damage you may do to the republic or the people or anything else. This struck me as psychopathic, sociopathic, a person without a conscience, which, of course, is exactly what it was. But I was still naive. I really couldn't believe that people could be that bad, that they would elect someone because the person remembered their names. Carnegie pointed out very correctly that for the average person, the most important thing in the world was his name. He's standing there looking at someone, a senator, president, or for that matter, a state legislator, who has enormous power over his whole future. And what he is interested in is not whether that person is going to have conscience or be concerned about the future of his state, his race, his country. He is fascinated by whether that politician knows his name. Carnegie was perfectly correct, but what he looked at as a human characteristic is what I look at as a curable disease. Strom Thurmond had a way of handling that. He had his staff there, and they would look up somebody before they showed up on Capitol Hill. And the person was very gratified to find that Senator Strom Thurmond remembered their names, the names of their family, and what they did for a living. He knew the right questions to ask. But some people felt terribly cheated when they found out that Strom Thurmond was actually doing his homework. He was having his staff do his homework. Well, if you're disappointed at that, you really need to see a competent psychiatrist. You're dealing with someone who has a very large amount of power. Strom Thurmond actually was famous all over Capitol Hill when I was working there as having the best staff on Capitol Hill as far as taking care of South Carolinians was concerned. They did miraculous things for us. Strom worked very hard for the people of South Carolina. When it came to remembering your name, he left that to the staff. And if worrying about someone remembering your name is the greatest thing in your life, you can kind of forget about having a decent government. And this brings us full circle right back to the concept of experts. An expert politician is one who knows your name, knows where you're from, knows about your family, knows about your apple pie, knows about what kind of fried chicken you like, or if he's from New York, about what kind of lox and bagels you like. He is not knocking himself out worrying about the future of the country or the issues that we must face in the future. That's the sort of thing he has to do on his own, which says a lot about the situation we're presently in. My congressman when I worked on Capitol Hill was John Ashbrook, and he had read my books. He had gotten some recommendations about me. He knew I was a thinker, because the first practical conversation we had when I became his staffer, he looked at me and he said, "Bob," he said, "I am busy all the time, day and night. I'm keeping up with my constituents. I'm giving speeches. I'm listening to speeches, same old speeches." He said, "I have no time to think." He said, "Bob, what you are to do for me is to think." Now, before you come to the standard conclusion that I get tired of hearing, that he was turning over power to me, he wasn't. I was supposed to read over his ideas and think from that base, think the way he would think if he had the time. I was not to take power. And if you're a congressional staffer and you think you have power, you will be shown out the door pretty quick. And what I was to think about was not the constituents. In fact, I was good at writing constituents' letters, and I could dictate one off the top of my head. And whereas the people who were assigned to these things took a lot more time than I did. But he forbade me to do that because, as he said, he had assigned me to think about things like the country's future. When he and I saved the space telescope in its early stages, it's the Hubble telescope, it was about to be cut out of the budget. I went to him and I said, "The Jupiter orbital probe and the space telescope need saving." He said, "Bob, is it good for America?" Now, this sounds like something out of a movie, but this actually happened. I said, "Yes, sir. It's good for America." So he got bought the time that was needed to get 400,000 telegrams in there from the space community, the people who are interested in space exploration. And we beat the chairman of the relevant subcommittee and the ranking member Republican. We beat them 4-1 on the House floor with practically the entire membership there. Just because I had done his thinking, which he hired me to do. And we saved the space telescope, and it's floating around out there because of a congressman from Ohio and his faithful redneck companion from South Carolina. That is the kind of thing he hired me to do. He had a conscience. He was worried about policy and things like that. But an expert politician is not supposed to be like that. He's supposed to worry about your name, which I consider thoroughly contemptible. Back in the 1950s, Europeans were kind of bemused by the American ability to get things done. Back then, Europe was very poor compared to the United States. I can hear the standard explanation charging forward. Well, they had World War II. Not really, actually. By the time I started working on a brick plan in Europe in 1959 in Germany, the European worker had reached a level of pay which was phenomenal by pre-war standards. They had had their economy blasted out and had followed American examples. And on the brick plant I was working on, the average or the minimum wage was about $18 a week. In the United States, it was $40 a week. But by European standards, that was quite a step forward. But they looked upon Americans sort of tolerantly. We seemed to know how to do things. We made a lot of money. But we weren't really experts in their sense of the word. The ultimate expert back in those days and thereafter, when I was nose to nose with the communists, to me the most contemptible, unspeakable expert was what was known as, quote, the European intellectual, unquote. These European intellectuals were pretty unanimously communists. They were at least socialists. In the, I forget exactly when Solzhenitsyn's The Gulag Archipelago came out, the French, quote, intellectuals, unquote, and trailing behind the little Italian experts or little Italian intellectuals. Suddenly, because Solzhenitsyn was obviously an intellectual, suddenly admitted that Stalin was not a nice man. They actually admitted that millions of people had been slaughtered and starved in the Soviet Union. They had always denied that before, because the Soviet Union was run by intellectuals, planners like themselves. Before Solzhenitsyn came out, he took it for granted that the average Italian college graduate was a Marxist. The whole movie industry in Italy was communist. All of the artists and all of the intellectuals were communists. They selected other people to be intellectuals who were communists. And so Americans were sort of unique in saying that communists stink and you have to know something or do something to be an intellectual or to be an expert. We are pretty well today back to the, quote, intellectuals, unquote, of Europe. And that is a major step back in evolutionary terms. We Americans were a very odd breed to the Europeans. I remember I was at a refugee conference in Berlin just before the Berlin Wall went up. I don't think it went up entirely because I was there, but I was talking with a Dutchman who was at the conference, and as we talked, he was looking up above us, and he said, and I asked him what he was looking at. He said, I was wondering if that lamp above us there, I'm not sure he'd call it a lamp, whatever was around the lights up there. He said, I was wondering if it was glass or plastic. So I took my shoes off, stood up on the chair, tapped it, and said, plastic, and sat back down. And he said, sort of proudly, to the other guy there, who was speaking German, he said, typisch Amerikaner, typical American. Instead of sitting there contemplating the thing, I just jumped up there and found out what it was. And that was more or less the European attitude. We were sort of an odd group of people we would go see. An expert in Europe did not go see. He would contemplate. We were barbarians, and they were intellectuals. The funny thing is that they had a certain feeling of gratitude for our existence, because while they were all intellectually Marxist, they really didn't want to be behind those Soviet lines. And the only thing that kept them from being there was the American. The only thing that kept their standard of living going up was the American. The Americans could just do things better than Europeans could, but their faith in the European intellectual never wavered. I wrote a piece in Whitaker Online about that was titled One America, Two Europes, because the standard liberal statement is that there are two Americas. But the blue states, let's see now, yes, the blue states, the liberal states, are European. There's no difference between the thinking of Massachusetts, the fashionable thinking in Massachusetts, or Ottawa, or in any other blue state, the liberal states. There's no difference between their thinking and European thinking. They are Europeans abroad. So, really, there's only one America. That's us old-fashioned Southerners and Westerners, and those of even New Englanders who still believe that to be an expert, you have to produce something. That communism stinks because they have to shoot people who try to escape. Simple stuff like that. On the other end, there are the Harvard intellectuals, or the Cambridge intellectuals, or the Sorbonne intellectuals in Paris, or the poor little Italian intellectuals who believe that intellectualism is the way to go. Whether it can produce anything or not is completely irrelevant. As Eric Hoffer said back in the 1960s, our Eastern intellectuals are simply Europeans. He said that John Kennedy was a European president. to a fashionable New Englander or a fashionable European, whether you actually produce anything or know anything is irrelevant. The point is, do you get the ordination, the approval of your fellow intellectuals? Now, before you get the idea that I'm saying that we are being driven back, I'd like to point out that this works in two directions. In Europe, there's a heavy underground of people who like to make money, who like to be practical. The problem with the American way is not that it is imperialistic. We don't really care whether anybody else adopts our ways. In fact, it's kind of nice if they, back in the 50s, it was kind of nice that they were so poor and we were so rich, because they slavishly worshiped their, quote, intellectuals, unquote, and their aristocracy and all those things. But the fact is that this American ideal, which is much harder to define, spreads simply because a lot of people want to live better. They don't want to be oppressed. Now, if you want to work for words, as Eric Hoffer said, the socialists are good at that. They ask people to work for words. American workers work for money. They work for results. And in the long run, the Americanization that Europeans worry about is to a large extent the result of the fact that the European approach doesn't yield anything. It doesn't provide anything. Looks good, but it doesn't actually provide any results. And the confusion between what they call American and what is simply practical, people who want to have diversity of opinion, people who want to have a higher standard of living, and the people who just want approval by the aristocrats or the intellectuals, this is not so much American as it is human. So while the Easterners and the liberals in the United States do represent an intrusion of 1950s European thinking into America, there's a certain contagion about practicality. One of the more obvious, and if you think about it, crazier examples of this is the constant repetition by the New York Times and all their little minions around the country of the mantra, yes, the crime rate has gone down, but the rate of incarceration has gone up. Now, many years ago, us unintellectual, thoroughly practical rednecks, noticed that crimes were going up because career criminals kept being let loose on the street. So our solution was, lock them up and throw away the key. The intellectuals, European and American, and by the way, the European crime rate is still going up wildly, but the intellectuals said that we need rehabilitation and all sorts of things. We didn't need revenge on the poor little criminals and all this stuff. And we kept saying, lock them up, throw away the key. So we began to lock them up and throw away the key. The rate of incarceration climbed, as we predicted. The crime rate went down, as we predicted. But the idea that a bunch of redneck Americans would know what they were doing just never occurs to an Easterner or a good, solid, fashionable European intellectual. And so they keep saying, well, yes, the crime rate has gone down, but the rate of incarceration has gone up. Which is sort of like saying, isn't there something strange about the fact that polio, the rate of polio has gone down, but the use of polio vaccine kept increasing all those years? The simple fact is they were wrong, and that is something that the European mind, including the fashionable New England mind or the Canadian mind, simply cannot assimilate. That we're right. What you do is you stick these career criminals in prison and we don't get robbed, crippled, killed, and disfigured. But the idea that they were simply wrong is absolutely impossible for the European mind to assimilate. So they keep having these frantic articles about the fact this must have failed, because this whole policy must have failed, because while us peasants getting murdered and raped and mugged on the street, that rate has gone down. The rate of incarceration has gone up. This makes perfectly good sense to them. They simply cannot consider cause and effect. And as I said, we're including Wall Street in this. We're including the selling of modern art in this, where some artist who's been praised by the New York Times can crack a toilet seat and sell it for $1 million. These people are, I would say they're insane. They're not really, because they make a good living off this. I suppose they make a good living off the idiots who think that these experts are doing something. It is infinitely easier to sell the idea that the experts are doing something wrong, or the European intellectuals are doing something wrong, or the Soviet intellectual is doing something wrong, than it is to sell the idea that titles, education, and all, they're doing nothing. They're a bunch of idiots. Well, they're silly. They couldn't be idiots. They make a good living at it. We're the idiots. I guess that's why it's so hard to sell. Respectable conservatives have learned this. They are paid to get on the national media and treat liberals with respect. They treat the PhDs with respect. And they say, well, I beg to differ. The reason old Bob is sitting here on the porch doing his talking free is because I'm looking straight at these people that the conservatives criticize, and I'm saying they're not doing anything. They're silly. They're ridiculous. There's nothing there. Goes right back to the Emperor's New Clothes, or to the statement that when the people lose respect for their leaders, the leaders lose power over the people. These people who are leading you into disaster are identified by respectable conservatives as leading you into disaster, but the respectable conservative knows better than to say that these people, titles and languages and all aside, these people are ridiculous. Revolutions come from people finally, after they've been mugged and raped and robbed, realizing that these people are not partially right. They don't have a point. They're not to be respected. What we call experts are ridiculous. Stone soup. They're producing nothing. And I suppose I will just keep on pointing this out until there's a revolution, or until I pass away, or maybe both, with recordings, maybe both.